KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Bay Area writer Isabel Allende joins us in conversation. We'll talk about a range of topics with her, including her newest book. It's a novel called Inez of My Soul, and she joins us for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Bay Area-based author Isabel Allende, who was raised in Chile, is the author of eight novels, including The House of Spirits and more recently Zorro, Portrait in Sepia, and Daughter of Fortune. She is also the author of three memoirs, a trilogy of children's novels, and a collection of short stories. Her most recent work, an epic of love and war, is Inez of My Soul, the story of a Spanish conquistadora, Inez Suarez, who is a Chilean national heroine and the founding mother, who lived in the 16th century and was the lover of Pedro de Valdivia, who conquered the indigenous Incas and Mapuches to found the city of Santiago in Chile. And Isabel Allende joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Michael.
We should begin, before we talk about this new novel, with a couple of things. One was we were both at the luncheon that was held in the Marin Civic Center for Barack Obama, and we actually sat together and had kind of a similar impression that I just wanted to talk about, although we said we wouldn't talk about election today, but he's not running for anything.
Yeah.
He was electrifying when he was in Boston at the Democratic National Convention, mm-hmm. but we both agreed he was kind of flat in terms of his presentation. Maybe he was tired or...
Yeah, that's what people say, that he was in a tour, that he was very tired. But we were waiting for him in a sort of an electrified mood. And people just gave him an ovation when he came in, and we were all so enthusiastic about it. And then he spoke for 10 minutes and just platitudes, nothing really important, nothing, no issues, no passion, no. So I was a little disappointed.
So and maybe he needs more seasoning or...
Maybe it was he was tired, but if I had 10 minutes in front of an audience, I would try to use them to the last second in really important things and not saying thank you to everybody who got involved in organizing the event.
Well, you use this hour as an example of the kind of revving up and passion and adrenaline that you're capable of. I think about Chile having its first woman president. I couldn't help thinking about you. I haven't even asked you about your impressions and reactions.
Well, Michelle Bachelet is an extraordinary person, no matter that she's a woman. It's fine that she's a woman also, but as a person, she's quite extraordinary. And she's doing a very good government with great support. She became the candidate practically by acclamation because nobody thought in Chile that a woman could be elected. Chile is a very male chauvinistic place, very patriarchal still. And although women have been involved in politics for decades, they never reach the higher echelons. And then the people asked for her to be the candidate. And so finally she was elected. And she's doing a government of consensus. She listens to everybody. She doesn't go to the political parties for decisions. And then she makes the final decision a little bit in the style of her authoritarian, loving mother. She very much projects that image of a mother.
How much authority and how much consensus, though? Government by consensus can be very slow grinding sometimes.
That's why she sort of listens first, and then she makes a decision. And she doesn't announce it before. And one thing that is interesting is that 64% of the national budget goes to social programs. Can you imagine what the United States would be like if 64% of our budget was for social programs? We would end poverty.
It'd be a utopia or something approaching that, possibly.
Yeah.
So you're pretty optimistic about her presidency then, it sounds.
Yes, like. And I like what's happening in Chile right now. It's a country that is doing really well.
Well, you're writing about history again and the history of your country in this new book, A National Heroine, otherwise some might say Pedro's mistress. I mean, there's a number of ways of viewing her, I guess, aren't there?
Yeah, but actually she's not a national heroine. Inés Suárez was the first, the only Spanish woman that accompanied the conquistadors that went in 1540 to found this place that Chile is now. And there were 110 men, thousands of Indians, and one Spanish woman. And she didn't go for glory or for gold as the conquistadors went. She went because she was in love with Pedro de Valdivia, the captain general. She was the lover because he was married. He never could marry her.
Well, she had been married too.
Yeah, but she was a widow.
Right.
So she was not doing anything illegal, let's say, but he was. And at a certain point in the story, the Inquisition stepped in. And so she was victimized by everybody, by historians, by the Inquisition. But she was a very strong woman. And she's not beloved in Chile because in the history books, she decapitated some Indians, Indian chieftains, toquis. And so she's depicted as this cruel woman.
Not only decapitated, but threw their heads over the terrorize those on the other side.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was in the middle of the Battle of Santiago when the Indians had burned the town, and they were lost. I mean, the Spaniards were lost. And then she makes this decision of decapitating the hostages and throwing the heads to the Indians. I don't know if I would have had the courage to do that, but obviously that saved the city. And so there's this ambivalence in Chile, as in everywhere, about the conquest. Should the Spaniards have gone to Chile, massacred people as they did, torture? This happened 500 years ago. There's no way that we can reverse history now. And we are, myself included, we are the product of this mestizaje, of this mixture of Spanish, Indian, African people, and many other people that came to Latin America. So that is unavoidable. We have to live with it. And try to explain it in a book is really fascinating.
Well, you have to get into the mindset of a very brutal time. I mean, it wasn't only the decapitation that makes it difficult to sympathize with her. I mean, we have almost natural political sympathies with indigenous people, but they were torturing animals because they felt that it would get back at the master. I mean, there were some dreadful kinds of things that you bring in.
Although the Mapuches were less brutal than most other peoples in Latin America, the worst were the Aztecs, by far. I mean, the brutality of the Aztecs is unbelievable. There were cannibals in the area of where today is Venezuela and part of Brazil. And the Incas were also quite brutal, not as much as the Aztecs. The Mapuches, however, were nomadic people that did not torture. They learned that from the Spaniards. And once they learned it, they applied it fully.
I'm talking with Isabel Allende. Her new book is called Inés of My Soul, and she's also the author of Daughter of Fortune. Book took 4 years of research. And how long did it take you before you actually occupied the voice of Inés? Because right away, the voice is really quite engaging. I mean, she talks about the plague following the death of Philip the Handsome, and she talks about the fact that she's a septuagenarian. She's 70 years old, and this character begins to come alive for us, right?
You know, Michael, it was so easy. I started all my books on January 8th. And on January 8th, I sat down, I had all my research, and I was going to write this book. And the first sentence just popped out. I mean, it came from my womb. I am Inés Suárez. I felt that was the only way that I could tell the story and bring the reader into the story. Because, you know, this is something that happened in a remote place 500 years ago. Why would anybody care about it? Unless it is told in a way that really grabs you by the neck.
Unless there's immediacy from a woman who's stubborn as a mule and who makes us realize that she is a strong woman and a strong voice.
And very
right away.
Courageous. I mean, she was brave.
Well, to come here from, I mean, to come to this part of the world from Spain to begin with and to take on what she took on and so forth. I mean, once again, you know, like, for example, I ask you about the first woman president of Chile and you say, well, you know, she's a good political leader. I don't necessarily emphasize the fact that she's a woman, but there is no escaping the fact that
that
she is
a woman. In that time especially, although the Spanish crown wanted the Spanish conquistadors to reunite with their families so that they would have Spanish families in the colonies, it was very hard for a woman to travel alone, especially if she had not been called by her husband. In this case, Inés' husband, Juan de Málaga, left for the New World. And then he never wrote, he disappeared. And after a couple of years, she decided to follow him and find him in America. She had no idea where America was, the size of America. She thought it was like going to Seville and asking around. And so she got an authorization from the king, an authorization from the church, and she did the incredible journey to get to America. And then she starts traveling by foot, by donkey, boat, whatever means she has. And she ends up in Cusco, the last town down south that you could go. And there she finds out that she's a widow. And instead of returning to Spain, where she had a family and a life, and she knew the rules of the game, she stayed. And then she became the lover of this man who unfortunately was married.
But it was a new world, too, for her. I mean, she would have probably been maybe a seamstress or something along those lines. In fact,
Absolutely.
She was destined, I guess her grandfather, because she wasn't a male, said he was not going to allow her to get married. She was going to have to take care of him. This is not uncommon.
Not uncommon that one of the daughters in a family would take care of the old people, and they were supposed to remain single and dedicate their lives to take care of the rest of the family.
Would have been a nun-like life, but this is a woman who was lusty and vital and had a great deal of courage.
And also, she was very healthy. And I emphasize this because this was a time where there was nothing available if you got sick. And she comes to the new world where she crosses the tropics and she doesn't get sick. And then she crosses the desert of Atacama, doesn't get sick. And then she lives to be 73 years old in Chile. Can you imagine? People died of an infected tooth. And she lived to be 73 years old.
Well, like I said, it opens up with the plague in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
The plague that was, I guess, believed to be part of Philip's death. The emperor dies, the king dies, and suddenly the plague comes. It seems cause and effect. Yeah.
Also, it seemed like a punishment of God also. And when Felipe died, his wife, Juana, who was called Juana, the crazy woman or the mad woman, La Loca, who was really not mad at all. She was just a poor victim of circumstances. She was madly in love with her husband. This was an arranged marriage. And they met when he was 19 and she was 16. And they saw each other and they had this lust affair immediately. They decided to get married that day so that they could have sex that night. And it was just this incredible passion. And then he died. And this woman went crazy with grief, and she by the way, she had 8 kids. She traveled around the country with the corpse of her husband for 2 years, and people said that provoked the plague. Well, that was one of the many things that people said at the time.
A lot of passion and a lot of profound kind of sexual passion as well as love. One phrase that kind of came out to me was, and this is, of course, Inez speaking, one day without seeing him, I was fervid. One night without being in his arms was torment.
Haven't you felt that way?
Well, you know what I thought? I was reminded of an interview I did with Edna O'Brien when she talked about just the mad animal hunger of love.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you get at here, and that's what's so...
But I think
it's love and war, as I said, an epic of love and war.
Especially if one is young. I think that it's part of the definition of love, that hunger, that lust, that urgency that you just can't live without it. It's an addiction.
In doing all the historical research that you did for this novel, did you find that there was, I mean, you did it for Daughter of Fortune too, certainly, but is there a problem sometimes with keeping with the character and keeping with the plot when you feel you have to have all of this backdrop and all of this data that you've processed and funneled through you?
I feel that it is important to convey the time without having the research show too much. So sometimes after the book is finished, I take out stuff that I
all
feel
those yellow post-its that
I take out stuff because I feel that it is just too much information.
We're talking with Isabella Allende. Her new book is called Inez of My Soul. There are resonances in this book, certainly, to today. I'm assuming that they were intentional. Torture, imperialism, search
occupation,
for gold,
invasion,
resources
greed,
and treasures to be taken, like oil.
Greed, cruelty.
I mean, you know, one can get pretty lachrymose thinking about how history continues to repeat itself. We think we're a long way from the era of the Inquisition, but are we?
I thought so, too, that I've always thought that history, and because I study history so much, it's like walking in a spiral. that we, it seems that we walk in circles, but we, in every instance, we learn a little bit, and we sort of keep ascending in a sort of spiral. But sometimes I'm just so disappointed. I've seen in my life so much brutality. Now, for example, with this torture bill in the United States, we are going back to the Inquisition times, where torture in interrogation is part of the deal. We had been able to eliminate that, although not in fully in practice, at least we had rules about it. And any democracy, any decent country would abide by the rules. And now we change them because it's convenient for us. I find it appalling.
Because from their perspective, it's war on terror. That's the argument, and that's the legitimacy
who,
that they
who defines this is the war of the poor to begin with, and then who defines who is the terrorist, who is the illegal combatant, who defines who is the enemy? They do. They define the rules. They define who is the enemy. They define how to apply the rules, and they change the rules when it's more convenient for them.
I certainly saw those parallels. I also saw parallels on the other side of the coin too. That is, the whole idea of the Spaniards is better for somebody to be burned alive than to go unsaved. I mean, it's very much like the fanatical strain of Islam.
Absolutely.
And there's also the very moving passage where men are sacrificing themselves in battle to protect other men, just 14 men, one by one, to hold back the enemy. Well, that also seems to resonate for a lot of the fanatic jihadists who feel, you know, they are putting themselves in death's way in order to further the cause.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a lot of echoes. But you find them in every moment in history. We haven't changed that much. I was trying to explain to my grandchildren who were doing a history assignment that people in other times, in earlier times, were not less sophisticated than we are. They were just as we are, with less technology. So the idea that they were simple-minded or that things were childish in any way, it's wrong. They were just as complicated and sophisticated and layered as we are today.
With the same universal drives and
the same passions.
Needs and passions and desires, yeah. Could you put yourself back in that time? Were you able to really do that?
Yes, I could put myself in that time, and I didn't like it a bit. I thought it was awful. The only thing I liked was that Chile at the time was still untouched. It was, nature was like paradise, the most beautiful country in the world. And they had not destroyed the forest. They had not polluted the waters. They had not destroyed anything. It was just gorgeous. And when Pedro de Valdivia arrives in the Valley of Santiago, in the Valley of Mapocho, where he found the city of Santiago, he looks at it and he realizes that all that crossing the Atacama Desert for 4 months, that all the trials and despair of the trip is worth it.
Because of the beauty of the place. Talking again with Isabel Allende, her new book is Inez of My Soul. January 8th is an important date for Isabel Allende because that's when she begins each of her new books, begins her projects. But September the 11th, not only a major date for those of us in the West because of the attack on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the plane going down in Pennsylvania, but September 11th was, of course, the coup d'etat date in Chile. And also September 11th appears in your novel, 1541, September 11th, 1541.
Yeah, September 11th, 1973, on a Tuesday, at the same time that we had the attack here of the Twin Towers in New York, we had the military coup in Chile. So the historical coincidence that it would be the same day of the week, the same day of the month, and at the same time of the day, it's really strange. And the same thing happened on a September 11th, 1541, when the Mapuche Indians attacked the city of Santiago for the first time. It wasn't a Tuesday, though. I had promised that if it was a Tuesday, I would have a statue made for Inés Suárez, but actually it was a Thursday.
How do you just to talk about the coup for a moment? It's always struck me as odd that the way the United States behaved in Chile with the CIA pretty much orchestrating that coup, that there isn't more hatred among Chileans. I mean, you compare, for example, the attitude that, say, people from Yemen or Saudi Arabia, like Bin Laden, have toward the West and toward America, wanting to, maybe like we were saying in the last hour with Max Boot, foment a Hiroshima in the United States or something like that. Chileans don't seem to feel this way. North Vietnamese don't seem to feel this way. Nicaraguans don't seem to feel this way.
I think that in many ways, people are able to separate Americans in general from the actions of the CIA or a particular government. We don't say Americans are all bad. Well, we say today. Actually, today the image of Americans in general has, people all over hate us. But it wasn't that way before. People in Chile, even, people said, well, this is the CIA. We never talked about Americans in general. And when I came to the United States, I realized that most Americans have no idea what the foreign policy of the government is. They don't even know where the CIA is working. They can't place it in a map. And our attention span is so short that we can only remember where something is when we are at war with it. For example, we knew where Afghanistan was a few years ago. Now we only know where Iraq is.
And many Americans don't know where Iraq is. No,
they can't place America in the map because they think that America is the map.
The lovers in your novel have a plan for a kind of new society. Christian, egalitarian, I mean, it's an idealistic plan.
Well, that was Pedro de Valdivia's plan. I don't know if Inés participated much in that plan, but he was a visionary. He wanted something different, and he wanted his name in history.
But he wanted glory, too.
He wanted glory. Yeah. He wanted his name in history, but he wanted to create a society that was not driven by gold. He wanted something different. Of course, it didn't work.
Is there a pattern to your historical novels? I mean, you've gone to California and now back to Chile, or is it just what the spirit moving you, impelling you?
The spirit
you?
Moving me. I have no plan for my life, Michael.
Like the rest of us. We're talking again with Isabel Allende. Tell me about the cover of the novel. I'm always interested in your covers. You found, in fact, this is a beautiful, I guess it's the Andes, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, actually, the cover for the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is the Spanish cover, a woman naked, with her arms open, exposed and defiant, with a young woman, defiant. But in the United States, you can't show nipples. So they changed the jacket, and here we have a different, more subdued jacket.
Which was that nice woman? I saw that picture. Where did you get that picture from?
It was just a photograph from the 1990s. I didn't find it. It was the publishing house.
And you're already on to another memoir, huh?
I finished another memoir of the recent 10 years of my family, but, you know, I write in Spanish, and I had to have the book translated in order for half of my family to read it, because they don't speak Spanish, the American side of the family. And I'm getting their feedback and making the adjustments. It's been really interesting, Michael.
Are they involved in a way that they're pleased about or not pleased about, or
well,
both?
We've had a lot of confrontation and tears and going back and forth and anger. It is as if in 10 years, the waters were settled and calm. And then there I come with a stick and I stir the mud in the bottom, and now everything is murky and everybody's in each other's face. But I think that in the long run, it will be good. We will have transparency again.
It's so hard, though. I mean, you know, talk with memoirists about this. This is
you are writing a
thing.
Memoir.
I am. I've actually finished the draft. And it's the most difficult thing, you know, to bring in those who don't necessarily want to be brought in, particularly in ways that... I remember Nulo Fuelen, the Irish memoirist, saying to me, you know, it's not worth creating havoc and dissension, to be sure. And in fact, Wole Soyinka, the Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian writer, saying to me, they didn't sign up for it, so I'm not signing them up for it, or words to that effect. And yet sometimes, if you're authentic to yourself, you can't avoid it. We'll talk more with Isabel Allende about her new novel, about Chile, about really whatever is on your minds. Join us. You can do that now if you'd like to talk with our esteemed novelist. Our phone number for your calls, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you wherever you're listening to Forum or however, radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Isabel Allende. Her newest book is called Inés of My Soul, and I want to mention the fact that she will be at Book Passage tomorrow at 7 p.m. in Corte Madeira, and on Thursday at Cody's at 12:30, and Thursday night at Kepler's at 7:30, so I think we've got the whole itinerary there. Yeah. Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with Peter in Berkeley. Morning.
Hi. I guess I have what I might call an audio email for you, Ms. Allende.
Yes.
I want to say thank you for the unique and almost magical, I would say magical blend of qualities which you have richly projected and shared with our society and the world over decades.
Oh, thank you so much.
Let me try to summarize. Imagination, courage, intelligence, refinement, gentleness, appreciation of the unique perspective of each culture and individual, and a voice to melt the heart of millions through the magic of radio.
Oh, wow. Are you married?
Not yet.
And she's also very attractive and vivacious. Let's at least add in addition to that. Peter, kind of you to call with all
Thank
those
you.
Lovely words, and we'll get more callers on here. We'll go to Beth. Morning.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Beth.
Hi, I'm calling to say thank you so much to the author because my 10-year-old daughter, who's an avid reader, spent the entire day on Saturday in bed. It was a beautiful day. We couldn't get her out of bed reading City of the Beast, which is, I think, an adolescent novel by Isabel Allende.
Or a novel for adolescents.
Yes. And my daughter tells me I have to read it because it's so wonderful. And then she got the sequel on Sunday, and I actually let her stay home from school yesterday, and she spent the entire day reading it. So,
do you recommend truancy for reading your books?
You know, tell your daughter that she doesn't have to read the third volume. They are going to make the movie of the trilogy.
Oh,
so she
no,
can watch the movies.
So thank you so much. She's just thrilled.
Thank you.
She's applying to middle school right now, and one of the applications asked her for her favorite novel, and she wrote City of the Beast, and she's describing it. So
good of you to call with that.
Okay.
Beth. Thank you. You've always been, it seems to me, very generous about the movies, the two movies that were made of your novels, because, first of all, it's very difficult. It's a whole different medium, you know, admittedly.
Yeah.
But I remember you were pleased with them both, and I kind of felt they didn't do the novels justice in many ways.
But I think you can't compare, Michael. It's another media completely. How are you going to compare a story that is several generations, 500 pages, and it has to be put in 2 hours in a movie? You can't do that without chopping half of it.
Well, like I said, it's an entirely different medium, and yet, you know, some films are probably better in rendering novels than others.
Depends on the story also.
Yeah, of course it
does. If the story is too complicated and too long, I mean, how can you do that?
Who's doing the third of the trilogy?
The same people who did Narnia.
Uh-huh.
And probably it's going to be filmed in New Zealand also, which is interesting. And then I have also an option for Zorro, the
Berkeley people who own the rights to Zorro?
Yeah, and Sony has the option, and they are going to do like the prequel of the Zorro movies that they have done.
With Anthony Hopkins or
Antonio
Banderas?
They are all too old, unfortunately.
can't make it, unfortunately.
Yeah,
that's too bad. Here's Ken, who says, you appear in American Experience program on the California Gold Rush. What is your role in this program? Did you provide information that the writers wanted you to present, or were the program producers just using your name, your very agreeable persona, your Spanish accent, your credibility to entertain and persuade the viewer?
Well, I just participated very slightly. I did not do any of the research, and I was not involved in the script or anything. I just did part of the narration and answered a few questions.
And maybe a question or comment from Juliana. Hi.
Hi, Ms. Allende. I'm so happy to be able to tell you how much I love your books. I read Daughter of Fortune as I was moving to California several years ago. I'm the only child to ever move so far from my family, so it's a big problem with my
family. Where is your family?
They're in Texas now, yeah. But I come from a very old Spanish family. Mm. They came over with the conquistadors and went back and forth to Europe for several generations. But I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on how far Spain has come from the Inquisition days to the way that they are now, a very liberal, progressive European country. And do you think that the U.S. will ever progress that far?
I think the U.S. is going backward. And
yes.
Europe, it's moving in the other direction. Of course, Spain has come a long way. And it's a very recent history for Spain because in the times of Franco, although they didn't have the Inquisition, it was a country that was closed to progress and close to the rest of Europe. It has come a long way in the last few decades.
Thank you, Juliana.
Thanks.
Appreciate hearing from you. Is it hard for you, I mean, because you're a woman of peace and you make no bones about that, so to speak, is it hard for you to write these kind of grisly, violent war scenes that really are an important part of the story?
Yes, I'm always shocked. Somebody asked me the other day, do you get numb after a while when you are researching about these horrible things? I never get numb. I am always horrified at the capacity of human beings to produce suffering, to destroy. It's never comforting. I never get used to it. I know a lot about torture because I started researching about it and learning about it in 1973 in Chile. Chile was the longest and most solid democracy in Latin America. We had never heard anything like torture or concentration camps. And in 24 hours, we had that all over the country. And I realized that the tortures were always there. The capacity to do that kind of stuff, to torture kids in front of their parents, to introduce rats in women's vaginas, to rape and to do all the things they did, is there, latent, in every human soul and in every society. And it's the rules that we establish, the rules of decency, the rules of the game that allow us to progress and to stop that evilness. And then, sometimes, given the wrong circumstances, that happens again and again.
Did you say it's in the potential of every human soul? I mean, do you include, well, for example, in the last hour we had Max Boot on, a historian and expert on warfare, and somebody said, why can't we think about peace in the way Gandhi thought about peace? I mean, are people like Gandhi still capable? Like,
you know, I think that it depends. Some people, I think that we are all capable. Some people rise above that, and some people never have the chance to exert that kind of evil. Some people just have better lives, and so they for myself, I'm privileged. I have never had to torture anybody. Would I do it? I hope I could say no. But sometimes the peer pressure, the circumstances, the fear is so great that you do it. You do it. And those 18-year-old kids that are fighting in Iraq today, they're terrified. Who knows what they're capable of doing?
I remember you once saying to me that if it hadn't been for writing and feminism, you would have been, I think I'm using your words here, a complete bitch. I don't know what that means.
Well,
exactly.
I'm still a complete bitch.
But, I mean,
I'm a rather flamboyant bitch, but I'm still a bitch.
But there's that idea that if you don't have a creative outlet, if you don't have a way of expressing yourself through politics, through ideology, through action, political action, or through creativity, that things can really go awry. You can get derailed and you can become, some would argue, more monstrous than perhaps you want to be.
Yeah, and also it depends on the accountability and how responsibility is distributed. One thing that I learned about torturers in Chile, why do they do it? First, they do it because they think that if they don't do it, it will be done to them or their families, that they're defending something greater than themselves, the fatherland or God, who knows. And then they know there's no accountability, there's impunity, and the responsibility is shared among their peers. So it doesn't have a name, it doesn't have their face.
But Chile, like South Africa, moved toward reconciliation and forgiveness. In a way, some would say that is not accountability.
It has taken 30 years, and there's no accountability. Very few of the torturers were really tried. And so they got away with it. They did.
Talking to Isabel Allende, and again, your calls are welcome. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Zashiel, do I have your name correct from Sacramento? Good morning. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to say that Miss Isabel Alegría is just a wonderful bridge to Latin America and to the U.S., and we need that much more exposure. She's a cultural, political, literary bridge that many times I feel that Latino America is invisible. And we need much more because many people, like she said, maybe don't even know what September 11th means to Latin America. But I congratulate her and congratulate you of having her there as well. I'm also a member of the media, but that's besides the point. I would love to also speak with her one day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. You see yourself as a bridge, like she said?
Yes, yes. I remember when I married, 20 years ago, I married an American. And
An American novelist, we ought to
say. He's now a novelist. And on this, in the ceremony, we both said, because he speaks Spanish and he has worked with Latin American immigrants all his life as a lawyer. And we both said, we held hands and we said, we want to be a bridge between our cultures. And I have really tried to bring Latin America in every book, in every public appearance, every reading, every lecture, to tell people who we are. And in my own life, I have tried to integrate everything that I brought with me with all the good things that I find here. And in a way, I have a sort of mixed tribe, and it works pretty well.
I love the story about when you came to the United States and the customs officer insisted that you were not white.
Yeah. I showed him my breasts.
You did indeed, right?
But I'm still not white. Yeah. I'm Latin American.
Take more calls. Lou, good morning.
Good morning. I've read this, and I don't know if it's true or not, but we like to think of Gandhi as being the perfect peaceful person, but Isabel's talking about the duality of people's ability to be cruel and, you know, to be good at the same time. I've read that Gandhi beat his wife with a cane.
Oh, my God. I had never heard that.
Never heard that either. But I know that Gandhi did test himself on his sexuality by lying naked next to women who are naked for periods of time to see if he could keep himself restrained, which is
interesting,
but not necessarily like beating a wife.
I think that is really pornographic, by the way.
Would not disagree. Where did you come across this, Lou?
I can't remember. I've read it a few times. I read a lot, and I didn't make it up, and it's not gossip, and I don't know if it's true because I obviously wasn't there. I've also read that the Dalai Lama was involved with the CIA and getting guns at one point before he escaped. So, you know, the violence thing.
Getting guns on behalf of Tibet, you mean?
Yes.
But wasn't he a child?
And being involved with the CIA at a certain point, you know, before he got out.
I think Isabel's got a point. Chronologically, that may not fit.
Yeah, because he left when he was very, very young. Yeah.
Or his brother, or in his name, or as I say, I've read these things, so I don't know whether it's true or not.
Well, you know what? We've got lots of fact checkers out there. I assume I'll get emails on this.
Yeah,
and we'll
find out.
Lou, thank you for the call. Appreciate your calling, and let's get Bill on next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My wife and I have been sincere supporters of the United Nations since 1962, and that's all the UN family of agencies. And I'm wondering how you fit the UN into your obvious global concerns.
I am concerned because it doesn't do the job that it should do. The idea is wonderful, and we should support it because it's our hope for the future, that we will be able to negotiate, compromise, have dialogue instead of war. And the United Nations can work toward that goal. Also, right now, the problems that the world faces are not anymore national problems. They are global problems. And I think that we need global solutions for these problems, drugs, violence, war, terrorism. All these things have to be addressed globally, and the United Nations could play a wonderful role there. It doesn't, unfortunately.
And why do you think it doesn't?
Because there's so much bureaucracy. I worked in the United Nations. That was my first job. And there is so much bureaucracy, so many people that have tenure there that don't do anything. And there is not enough support from countries like the United States.
Of course, what you say about tenure and entrenched bureaucracies is true of any big bureaucracy. We were talking last hour with Max Boot. He was speaking about how an efficient bureaucracy does much better in terms of making war, and the United States has not an efficient bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Too bad the United Nations can't realize its hope. Some say it's because it's got too much hegemony by enemies of the United States. At least that's the official word that one hears from on high, from the public.
But also there's no support of the United States right now, is there?
Right now, no, there isn't. You're right. Adrian, good morning.
Morning. Hola, Isabel. Mi nombre es Adrián.
Hola.
¿Cómo estás? I was also born in Chile and left 1975 to Venezuela. And I used to read in El Nacional your articles that were awesome. It made me laugh a lot. And then I ended up in the Simón Bolívar University of Simón Bolívar, in the same school where your son went, even though I never met him. So, and then I ended up in the Bay Area with the love of my life, my wife. So it's a kind of coincidence, past in life. I found out that you were also in here, and I love your books. But I wanted to ask you about how you feel about Chile today and what is it going as a country. I have sometimes mixed feelings. even though it has developed economically, I see also it has lost some of the spirit that I remember as a child that it had in the 1970s, equality, and kind of the passion that the people had about equality and about dignity. Human dignity today seems to me a very individualistic society.
Yes, you're right. That is lost, and not lost, but dormant. And Chile is a country that has incredible inequality. There's a few people who make incredible amount of money, and they control most of the economy, and there's a lot of poor people. However, in the last 7 or 8 years, the country has been able to lower the poverty from almost 30% to 16%, and it's going down and down. So the governments that we have had since we have had democracy in 1990 have really tried to make that horrible difference smaller, and I think they're getting there slowly.
Let me thank you for the call, Andrea, and then ask you, Isabel, about I think the word is extraño. You know, you get this kind of homesickness welling up in you for Chile. It just comes uninvited. And
No, I go to Chile all the time, so I don't feel I don't feel like as I felt when I was living in Venezuela and I was a political refugee and I couldn't go back. Then I had that paralyzing feeling of nostalgia, and every time Chile was mentioned, I would feel like crying. I don't feel that way anymore. And now I go to Chile, and I'm really happy when I get there and really happy when I get out.
How did your book about Chile, it was certainly a bestseller in Chile, and lots of people read it. I mean, you were wont to describe the national character and how people were and their sense of humor. And
yeah, my invented country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, my mother said, people will hate you for this, but they didn't. Chileans have a self-deprecating humor that I can relate to. And being a Chilean myself, I can write about all our defects, but you try, Michael, and they will kill you.
Here's an email from a listener named Joe who says, I share your abhorrence of America's imperial theocracy. I grieve to imagine the meeting in the White House between Alberto Gonzalez, Dick Cheney, and George Bush when they settled on waterboarding as the technique of choice. One wonders if they had seen the Battle of Algiers, and he says, thank you for your beautiful work. But he also has a question. It's about Chile. I plan on spending next year in Chile, in large part so that my daughter, who will be 5 when we go, can learn Spanish. We would like to live in some place that is rural but close to a city of some size. We're considering Valdivia.
Yes, Valdivia. I was going to say that.
Interestingly enough, the name of the character in your book. Or Puerto Monte.
Do you have both. Puerto Monte and Valdivia, both great cities in the south. Water cities. Valdivia is very green and luscious and with a lot of water and rivers, and people are really nice. I'm very glad that you've decided not to go to Santiago but to another city, because everything is centralized in Santiago, and Santiago is a harsh city in many ways. The south is just very pleasant.
And then we go to more of your calls. We go to Petaluma. Gail, morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to respond to your comment on being a bridge and wanting to be a bridge. I moved to Puerto Rico 18 years ago, and I read House of the Spirits before I left. And while I was down there, I read your books in Spanish. I just wanted to mention, I think you write in Spanish, do you not?
Yes, I do write in Spanish, but I have a very good translator.
You do indeed. But I just wanted to mention to the listening audience that if you know any Spanish and want to enhance your ability to read and speak Spanish, that your books are just wonderful. They're so descriptive, and they're so easy to follow the context, even if you don't know every single word. And I want to thank you for making it possible for me to learn to read in Spanish.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. I think I told you I read Paula in both Spanish and English, and I must say it does lose. I know you have a good translator, and I think highly of her work, and I know you do as well, but you can't help losing in translation.
Translation is more than changing words into another language. You have to adapt the text to the culture. There are things that don't work in English. For example, sometimes I have a love scene in Spanish, and we agree with my translator that it doesn't work in English because it sounds tacky, corny, suspicious even. In the case of Inés of My Soul, we went back and forth with the title for months, because Inés of My Soul is not something that you would say in English. And it's really something that you would say in all Spanish. In English, you would say Inés of My Heart. And I fought for the Inés of My Soul like crazy, because it doesn't mean the same thing. And everybody said it sounds strange in English. So you see, you have to adapt it to the culture sometimes.
You know, when you said before that Inés of my soul, or the voice of Inés, the character came to you from your womb, I thought to myself, why not your soul?
Yeah.
I was struck by that.
Well, because she's so lustful, she's so much in life. Although she was a fervent Catholic, and she founded churches, and she was very involved with religious orders, yet she was a very practical and greedy woman in many ways, lustful for life.
You remember the scene where she gets undressed? I mean, can you describe what we see
in
the cross of the petticoat? And
but that's not her.
That's
the wife of Pedro de Valdivia.
That's Pedro, yeah.
Pedro de Valdivia. And this is not something I invented, Michael. People think that I have this pathological imagination. I don't. I research.
We should tell listeners what we're talking about here.
So this is the new bride, a teenage bride, and Pedro de Valdivia has married her. And the night of the wedding night, when he meets her in bed, she's wearing this nightgown that is tied at the neck and the hands, and is covers her completely to her feet, and it has an opening where he can make love through, and the opening has the shape of a cross. And this nightgowns with these openings in the shape of a cross were common at the time, and they were common in the 19th century, not so long ago.
This is a tricky question, but I've heard people who were brought up staunchly Roman Catholics say that because Catholicism has so much of a inveighing against thinking sexually, I mean, thinking needs to be confessed like the acts, and the thoughts are the acts, that it increases one's sense of sexuality.
You see the priests? but you know, I think that's true about Catholicism, but at least we go to confession and we start all over again. We start sinning again and with a clean soul. But you, Protestants, I mean, you're not, but Protestants in general, they don't even have that outlet. Or
you sound sympathetic.
Yeah.
Well, fine. Adam, join us. Morning.
Yes, good morning.
Are you on a speakerphone, Adam?
How's that?
That's much better. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Isabel, for your beautiful work. It's a great gift to all of us.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask, where do you think art fits into our struggles today with this world in deepening crisis? And what is the relationship between art and healing?
I think that art is the expression of the common dream, the common hope, the common consciousness. The artist, the writer, usually doesn't know what he or she is doing. You just have to do it because you tap into something that is out there, that is belongs to everybody. And sometimes a work of art can represent a moment or an event in ways that nothing else can. You can write 1,000 history books about Vietnam, and yet the image that you have of Vietnam is one snapshot of a little girl running while napalm is burning behind her. And that image, that photograph, is a work of art because it represents something that is much larger than any description. It's engraved in our memory, in our soul, in our consciousness. So that's the role of art. The role of art is to go ahead, showing the way, and also behind, recording what we do, what happens.
You believe in the transformative power of art?
I do believe that in the long run, art is transformative.
Meaning what, the long run?
I don't think that there is an immediate effect of a book or a work of Guernica by Picasso. But in time, 50 years later, you look at that painting and you realize what it is. And you will always remember Guernica. You will always remember the Civil War in Spain.
They're sort of like molecules that stay inside you, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, you know, yes.
I've used that analogy before.
And then when he painted that painting, he was not aware that he was doing something that was a work of such magnitude, and he could not be aware that that was the painting that was going to survive for centuries.
Let me get you on, Pierre. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's always a pleasure to read and hear you, dear Isabel Allende. What I wanted to tell you was that I have a Chilean story that I would very much like to send you. I am not a writer, so it could be a mini novel, except that it is a true story. Will I send it so that you will receive it?
Can you please send it here to the radio, and Michael will send it to me? Because I'm in book tours, I'm in and out, and it might get lost.
So you can do that, Pierre, and I'll have a look at it if you don't mind myself. Maybe.
Yeah, but don't steal the story, Michael.
No. Incapable of doing that. It's in my DNA. Again, let me tell you where you can actually meet Isabel Allende and talk about her new book. She'll be at Book Passage tonight at 7 p.m., in fact. Mm-hmm. Will you be reading or talking?
A reading and talking about the book.
About Inez of My Soul?
Yeah, this is the first reading of the book tour, so I don't know what I will do.
Well, that's in Corte Madera, so you can come and find out what she's going to do, because she hasn't planned, like her life, what she's going to do tonight. She'll also be at Cody's on Thursday at 12:30 and at Kepler's 7:30. And siempre mucho gusto. Thank
Gracias.
You so much.
Gracias.
We'll be back with you if all goes according to plan tomorrow. And you know what we're going to be doing tomorrow? We're going to be doing election analysis, the first hour nationally, and the second hour we'll take up the state and local elections. I hope you will be able to join us for that. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.